And welcome once again to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, California, and on the web at KUCI.org. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, poets, literary agents, and editors discussing the art and the business of writing. And before we go on, let me say that the views and opinions and everything you hear on this show today all belongs to me and my guest, and not the University of California Regents. Today my guest is Dani Shapiro. She is the author of three novels, Playing with Fire, Fugitive Blue, and Picturing the Wreck, and the best-selling memoir, which she talked about here on this show a couple of years ago, Slow Motion. She teaches in the graduate writing program at the New School and has written for The New Yorker, Granta, Elle, and Plowshares, among other magazines. She lives with her husband and son in Litchfield County, Connecticut, and her new novel is Family History, published by Knopf. Hi, Dani.
Hi, Barbara.
So you're in a big power outage, you were telling me when we first spoke.
Yeah, well, actually, we're pretty lucky here in Connecticut, but all around us there's no power, up and down the East Coast.
But the phones are working. A good thing.
Absolutely.
Tell our listeners about Family History.
Well, Family History, in many ways, is a novel about motherhood. It's the story of a woman named Rachel Jensen, who is an art restorer and happily married to Ned, who is at the point where the book opens. Rachel and Ned are both sort of in early middle age. They're in their late 30s or early 40s. Hard to know exactly where middle age begins.
Mm.
And they have a teenage daughter, Kate, and they're both grappling with, I think, some fairly usual disappointments and concerns about where their lives are, but essentially they're pretty happy. And then Kate, their daughter, comes home from camp one summer when she's 13 and is just a changed kid. And their secure and happy family life starts to really unravel. And the story is as much about that unraveling as about Rachel's responses to it. And also, Rachel is the daughter herself of a very difficult mother. So the idea of being a perfect mother is very important to her, and having a perfect child, which, you know, whatever that is.
Yes.
And so much of who Rachel is as a character is informed by her relationship with her own mother, Phyllis.
Hmm.
So in many ways, you know, of course, this is all in retrospect. I didn't understand any of this as I was writing the book, but once I finish a book, I always try to understand what it is I've done. And in Family History, I now see it in retrospect as really a story of a matriarchy.
Hmm. How did it begin then? And it sounds like you didn't plot it out.
I never plot my books out. The only book of mine that I ended up having to plot out was my memoir, Slow Motion.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really because ultimately, as a journalist friend of mine pointed out to me, it was nonfiction and I knew what happened.
Right.
So discovering what happened wasn't the journey. The journey was how to tell it.
Mm-hmm.
And the art in it, or, you know, the attempt toward literature was how to tell the story. In my novels, the journey is largely what is the story. They almost always begin with character. And in Family History, really what I started with was this image I had of this woman lying in bed watching old movies of her family. And everything has fallen apart around her, and I didn't know why. I really didn't know much about her at all, except I felt compelled to find out what had happened to shake up what had been such a solid foundation.
Hmm.
And I think that came out of, I certainly fall into the category of writer who writes out of my own worst fears.
Yes.
And as someone happily married and the mother of a young son myself, I think the question sort of formed for me of what could possibly happen to shake this up. And then I created the characters of the Jensens, and I kind of let their story build from there.
Hmm. That's interesting because it was an emotionally wrenching book, or it is. It still is an emotionally wrenching book, except I've gotten through the wrenching part, and I find it amazing and admirable when novelists do deal with these topics that, to me, it seems like it would just be, you know, an awful time writing it because of having to live in that world.
Mm.
How do you deal with that?
You know, somebody the other day asked me whether I was as anxious writing it as she was reading it. And I kind of was. This was a hard book to write. I was very resistant to it when I started it. And I think I was resistant to it for a lot of reasons, but when I started it, I wrote the first chapter and I really hated it. And I actually deleted it from my computer and I took the only hard copy I had and I put it on the top shelf of my closet, and I was feeling just completely devastated because it had been a couple of years and I had started other attempts at novels and nothing was working, and it had been a long time since I had written fiction because my previous book had been a memoir and I had written this long piece for The New Yorker that was also memoirish, and it had just been a really long time, and I thought, I've lost this muscle, I don't know how to do this anymore. And that night I went out to dinner with a girlfriend, and I was just lamenting how bad I was feeling. And she said, you know, let me read those pages. And she wasn't a writer. If she had been a writer, I never would have given it to her. Because mm-hmm. I just was so convinced they were awful. And I gave them to my friend, who's actually a therapist. And she called me up after she got home. She took the subway home. This was in New York City. And she said, you're crazy. This is the best thing you've ever done. And that's how kind of changeable and how uncertain my process was while I was writing it. It wasn't a book I loved. And interestingly, I think as I go along as a writer, and I don't like to think this, but I do kind of believe it, that the less I love my work as I'm doing it, probably the more on track I am with it. That the idea of loving one's work while one's working on it is probably a dangerous thing.
That's interesting.
I flashed back to this thing when I was in graduate school. Grace Paley was my teacher.
Mm, how fortunate.
She was just the most amazing teacher, the most amazing writer and human being and teacher. And she would say these things. I mean, some teachers are really good on the page and are really very, you know, intense kind of like teaching you things about craft. Grace was more the kind of teacher who would say something, and 10 years later you remember it. And this thing that she said was that if she loved a sentence that she had just written enough to want to go read it to her husband in the other room, she knew she should throw it out.
Really?
Yeah. And at the time, as a graduate student, I had no idea what she was talking about. But now, you know, years later, I start to understand that there's some kind of delicate balance between being completely immersed in a work and also being able to cast a cold eye on it,
mm-hmm.
even at the same time.
Sure. That's interesting. Oh, you're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm speaking with Danny Shapiro, author of Family History. That's interesting, too, because what I see with my students often is that if they're not enjoying what they're writing, or they think their sentences are lousy, or, you know, nothing's coming out that they love, they abandon whatever they're working on, or they want to. Of course, with nagging, they keep at it. But how do you know when what you're working on is really something you should abandon because you're having no fun and it's not interesting to you, or at least the writing isn't, and when it's working, only you can't see it?
Well, I think that there's a hump that you have to get over in any given piece of work, because every piece of work is an act of faith that you're doing something worthwhile. And there's a difference between what I'm saying, which is sort of the, you know, the many years down the road kind of way that I see it for myself now, and how I think of, you know, and how I talk to my students about this, which is about quieting those voices inside your head that tell you that you can't do it, you know, and, you know, quieting that inner editor sitting on your shoulder saying, you know, this is no good, this is no good, this is no good, as you're doing it. There has to be at least enough of a propulsion into it to get it down. And I would say that at a certain point writing family history, I couldn't stop writing that book. I had to get over that hump, and that was the 30 pages I was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I never was comfortable. It was a very uncomfortable book to write because it was, you know, these people were going through a very tense time, and I myself did not know how it was going to turn out for them. So I was tense. But at a certain point, I was completely immersed in their world. And I mean, to give you an example, when I was about three-quarters of the way through writing the first draft, I guess, when September 11th happened.
Mm.
And for a long time, I didn't pick it up again. Nobody I knew was picking up their work. It felt sort of impossible.
And you were living in Manhattan then, weren't you?
I was living in Brooklyn.
Uh-huh.
And very close to the towers.
Right.
And I remember once I even had a thought about my book, the thought was, who cares? Who cares about this family? Who cares about these people? This is all irrelevant. Everything pre-9/11 is irrelevant. And that feeling lasted probably for a month or two. And what started to emerge, and I think it had something to do with reading all of those small stories that the New York Times published,
mm-hmm.
Portraits in Grief,
yeah.
where every single person whose family was willing, who had died in either the Pentagon or the planes or in the towers or on the ground, had this little, tiny little personal, intensely detailed biography written about them in the Times. And I read them obsessively, and I remember it at some point connecting those stories to my story in the sense that I realized that every single death, every single loss, every casualty was a whole, it was a person who had a whole story. And somehow it felt, and especially because I'm a writer and I'm not equipped to do anything else, it felt like I had to go on telling this story of this family who were in a state of acute anxiety and fear and dislocation that in some ways was similar to what was kind of happening in the national psyche.
Mm-hmm.
But it was more of just this feeling of the specific domestic stories do matter.
Yeah.
And as fiction writers, all we can do is make them up.
Mm. Well, this book, the characters are so well drawn. You go way in with your characters, and I guess I wonder how there also seems to be a line there somewhere that you can get too close to characters. Like there's almost too much, and yet you never cross that line. There's just sucks you in from the beginning. You stay with the characters, you stay with the story, and you feel like the author had a certain control, a necessary control over themselves as they're writing. When you're dealing with emotional topics like this and all the things that are going on in this book, do you feel yourself needing to pull back, or are you just letting it rip and you just deal with it on the revision if there's excess or you know?
Yeah, no, that's really interesting, and thank you for saying that, because I mean that really was important to me. This writing this book was this delicate balance between emotion and control, and yeah, I pretty much did let it rip, but I also was very constantly aware. I mean, I was both letting it rip and casting the cold eye, as I was talking about before.
Yes.
So both, for the first time in my writing life, I think both things were alive in me simultaneously.
Oh, that's interesting. Hmm. Well, how was it to go from your last book, a memoir, to fiction? And I guess in between or during, you also do articles and essays and other things. How do you keep it all filed, separate? you know, in your creative mind?
Well, I certainly couldn't do both simultaneously. I can't do anything simultaneously, but it required such different muscles to write nonfiction, to write the memoir, because really, writing slow motion, it was writing out of memory. And I was so accustomed up until that point to writing out of my imagination. And it was really like a runner trying to do yoga, or you know, I felt like I was just completely the muscles that I needed I had to be strengthened and learned how to be used. And also writing memoir, I mean, slow motion was a very exposing book in a lot of ways, and in a way, writing slow motion liberated me, as I thought it might. I had some notion that I had to write that book because it would change my fiction. And I think it did, although I don't entirely understand it yet. I feel very much freer to write what's intensely personal to me in my fiction, which does not mean it's autobiographical. I mean, Rachel Jensen really isn't me, but so much of who I am and what I feel and what goes on inside of me is informs her character.
Sure.
And the issues in the book, I mean, I had just become a mother myself when I started, or I had a young son when I started writing family history, and the profound vulnerability of you know, what happens to you when you become a mother and you feel like you can't protect your own children, which you can't. You know, we can't protect each other, and you know, quite literally. And that was so kind of blindsiding to me and so important to me to find a way to explore. I wouldn't have wanted to write nonfiction about that. I needed to find a way, a shape of a story to be able to explore it.
You're listening to Writers on Writing, and today I'm with Danny Shapiro, author of Family History, published by Knopf. I wanted to ask you about something, a quote, actually, that I read in the Litchfield County Times Monthly when we were back east in April. There was just, I found it really amazing picking up this paper, and there's an interview with you. And you said, "There are writers who are too smart for their own good. The best writers are able to be dumb like an animal when they are writing their books and only be smart when they are revising them." Mm. Would you elaborate on that?
Well, I guess what I really feel is that I know for myself when I finish a book, I have no idea how I did it. And that if I ever really completely understood it, the magic, when I say dumb like an animal, it's kind of a very, it's that not editing that I was talking about. Trusting that the unconscious has its own coherence.
Yes.
And that it really will, if left to its own devices, create some sort of narrative and story and arc. And only harnessing that after it's down, which is hard to do. It's using completely different parts of but I do think that the best writers have both, have the ability to be really kind of innocent on the page and in some way playful. I know when I thought about that for the first time, I was watching a Woody Allen movie. And I don't remember the title of the movie, but it was there was a moment in the movie where everybody's in a funeral parlor, and all of the corpses get up and start to dance and sing. You remember that moment?
What movie was that?
I can't remember. I was sitting in the theater, and I thought to myself, now that is the kind of idea that an inner censor would have just edited out before it ever hit the page. And the thing that makes Woody Allen a great filmmaker, you know, when he's great, is that wound up in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't say, I can't do that. Singing, dancing, corpses, I can't do that. And, you know, yes, sometimes you get that down, and then later, you know, casting the cold eye, looking at it analytically, no, you can't. You know, sometimes, you know, it's like, no, that really was a bad idea. But if you don't let the idea live and breathe to start with, if your filter filters it out before it ever even has a chance to, you know, to take some sort of root, then, you know, one loses so much of what is possible.
Hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. Not editing before, or not editing your thoughts.
Right.
Letting him go down on the page. Will you read to us?
Sure. What I thought I would read is a section where Rachel tells her mother, I love reading sections with Rachel and Phyllis, where she tells her mother that she's marrying Ned. It's a flashback. It's from earlier in their life. And if I'm not exactly sure how long it is, so if I'm going on too long, just stop me.
Okay.
I avoided telling my mother that Ned and I were getting married for as long as I possibly could. She didn't like sudden news, and she didn't much like Ned. Nice Jewish girls weren't supposed to marry artists. My choices were doctor, lawyer, banker. I was upsetting the natural order of things. What's the rush? My mother asked me over coffee at Bergdorf Goodman. All around us, well-coiffed women with shiny, unscuffed handbags were sipping mineral water and picking at their salads. My mother looked like all these women. She had her hair and nails done at Elizabeth Arden, and most of her wardrobe came from the very same department store in which we sat, sipping coffee. I did not look like the women of Bergdorf's. I had gone out of my way not to. My hair hadn't seen scissors in years. It was curly and long, and for the occasion of my ladies who lunched date with my mother, I had worn baggy Levi's and a big men's shirt of Ned's, which hid... Oh, I'm sorry, I should have mentioned that Rachel is newly pregnant, and her mother doesn't know this yet, which hid my slightly swelling belly. Years later, I grew to love clothes and to see them as a uniform of sorts, as armor. But back then, I was busy trying not to be anything like my mother. I enjoyed seeing the flicker of disapproval dance across her face as I approached her from the escalator. But she was determined to have a pleasant lunch. Pleasant lunch would have been her term. So she arranged her mouth carefully into a smile and hugged me ever so briefly, hello. My mother had an agenda that day. She always did. She spoke in lifts. A, it seems to me you could wait at least until summer, she said. The weather's so iffy in the spring. And B, why have the wedding in Massachusetts? Your family is from here. I know, Mom. I couldn't bear stating the obvious, which was that my family, as she put it, consisted of one person and one person only, and she was sitting there, right there in front of me in all her powdered glory. My father had died of lung cancer when I was still in college. I had no sisters or brothers. Neither of my parents had siblings. There were no cousins, no aunts, no uncles, no nobody, just Phyllis. We were a family of free-floating loners, only children begetting only children. I found it horribly depressing. One of the upsides now of moving to Hawthorne was the thrill of getting away from it all. And see, I want to give the rehearsal dinner at my home, said my mother. Traditionally, the rehearsal dinner is something the groom's family does, I said. Since when have you cared about tradition? She had a small, dark speck of lettuce stuck to her pale pink lipstick. Jane and Arthur are going to give the rehearsal dinner at their club. Oh, of course, their club. What's that supposed to mean? Nothing, nothing at all. I saw my mother as infrequently as possible, which still amounted to at least once a week. Being the only daughter of a widowed mother, and in particular of this widowed mother, was the strangest thing about my life. I couldn't explain it to anybody. None of my friends in our tender early 20s had lost a parent. None had a sense of responsibility for a parent. Most of them still had families who took care of them, who brought them casseroles and helped them with their taxes. In some dim way, I was aware that I had the duties, if not the emotional life, of a woman twice my age. I'm pregnant, Mom, I blurted out. I hadn't meant to say it. There was no reason for her to know. I was only 3 months along, and I was still barely showing. I knew it, she murmured. You knew what? That I was pregnant? I felt suddenly vulnerable. Saying it out loud, saying it to my mother, made me feel unsafe, as if I had put the baby in jeopardy. I'd trip down the escalator on my way out of the store and miscarry in a painful, bloody mess on the plush carpet surrounded by Giorgio Armani suits. I'd give birth to a deformed, doomed infant. The key word was doomed. How could anything good come out of me when I came from this angry, messed-up woman? "This is terrible," my mother said softly. "What did you say?" "Terrible," she repeated. "You're ruining your life." I wanted to scrape back my chair, grab my coat, and run from the restaurant, but I couldn't move. I was rooted to the spot, poisoned, numb. I stared at the woman across the table from me. Her lips trembled and her eyes were wild, pupils jiggling, rippling like tiny stones cast into a calm, shallow pool. Who was she? I felt no love for her, and yet I couldn't leave. 1,000 invisible threads bound us together, and when I tried to squirm away, they just got tighter. She was my mother. She could say whatever she wanted to me, and no matter how ugly, how hurtful, I couldn't walk away. There was no one else to take my place. Countless times I had imagined a sister, a brother, someone to pick up the slack. "Could you go pick up Mom at the doctor?" I'd ask, or, "Mom's acting crazy. Do you think we should call a shrink?" "You have all the time in the world," she was saying. "Why do this? How are you going to afford grad school, child care? Have you thought these things through?" All right, I'll stop there.
Thank you very much. Oh, I have so much to ask you. That was Danny Shapiro reading from Family History, published by Knopf. We're going to take a real short break. We'll be right back with more Danny Shapiro. Don't go away. And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, California. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine. And I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. And, we're also on the web at KUCI.org. So tell your friends from afar that they can listen over their computer. I'm here today with Danny Shapiro, author of Family History, published by Knopf. I wanted to ask you something else. In hearing you read that section, I remembered, because it's been more than a month since I read your novel, I remember your details, and you put them in at just the right time, like the detail in what you read, the small speck of lettuce stuck to her lipstick. How does that happen for you? Is that something that just, you know, you must just be so attuned as a writer. You're in this emotional scene and the details do not escape you, which is, I think, a wonderful skill.
Thank you. Details are not something that I'm consciously trying to put into a scene when I'm writing a scene, but I am aware in a general way that the tiny details are what ground you in a scene. It's not something I'm thinking about as I'm writing, but I think it's something that that I understand as sort of over time, is that you don't need to describe a whole house. If you describe the dust bowl on the corner, we see the house. Or you don't need to describe somebody's whole outfit, but if we see a scuffed heel, or that she's missing one earring, or that her eyeliner is purple or on crooked, or whatever the detail is, it just visually creates something for the reader that really shows them the character or the place.
Yeah. It's interesting because, you know, that detail more than anything, I think, you know, I saw the mother.
Mm-hmm.
There was the mother right there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I wanted to know a little bit about, well, first of all, let me say, when I was reading Family History, I felt that, and this is before, I tend not to read any promo or PR on articles, anything about the authors before I read the book, because I don't want to be influenced. And I had the distinct feeling that that you as an author had a lot of knowledge, firsthand knowledge about the sort of, worry, panic, fear that Rachel
mm-hmm.
was going through.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that. I know you've written about, in nonfiction, mm-hmm. you've written about panic disorder and,
mm-hmm.
and all that. Could you talk a little bit about that, especially as it relates to being a writer and sort of actually finishing wonderful books and publishing and being a mother and
I think that to back up, I think that I have suffered from a kind of anxiety disorder with elements of panic and panic attacks really my whole life, but I never knew what it was until recent years. And I think even the word panic or the word anxiety means very different things when used by people in kind of a casual way or when used in a clinical way.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that writing books, becoming a writer, realizing that I was a writer and beginning to kind of allow what was in my head to start to take shape in stories was what saved me. Joan Didion once was quoted as saying that had she had even the remotest access to her own thought process, she never would have become a writer.
Mm.
And I loved that, and I really recognized it when I read that in something that she wrote, because I, for most of my early life, did not have access. I just had this kind of constant buzzing thrum in my head. And I actually think I would still have that constant buzzing thrum in my head, except that I sit down most days and organize it.
Yeah.
If I didn't have that, I'm not sure what would happen with all that, because it needs to have a place to go. And I think in my case, and I come by it in every possible way, biologically, genetically. I think both of my parents had anxiety disorders. My father certainly had panic attacks. My mother was just a phenomenally anxious person. And also the events of my life, and I've had a life that has had some sudden calamity in it. So that I'm very attuned to, it's like, well, I don't mean to throw around psychiatric diagnoses, but it's, or terms, but it's like post-traumatic stress.
Mm-hmm.
When something happens that's sudden and calamitous, it's very familiar to me.
Yeah.
One of the first thoughts I had today when I heard that New York City was in this blackout was I thought those poor people stuck in elevators and in office buildings, they must be having flashbacks to September 11th.
Yeah.
Because I know I would have been, and I'm sure a lot of them would be, because once you've been in a trauma, small traumas set off the large trauma again. And so I think in terms of being a writer and in particular writing family history, I was exploring that. And it's not exploring it in remotely a therapeutic way or a cathartic way, which I think ends up not creating good art.
Right.
It's just simply exploring it. I don't think there's anything to be done with it. I don't think it's something that will ever entirely go away or be healed. I think it's something that will come and go. It will wax and wane depending on what else is going on in my life. I found myself as a mother of a young child really feeling that set off in me, because I was so worried about him, and we went through some scary moments with my son when he was a baby, and he was quite ill for a short period of time, and he's thankfully completely fine now, but we had a real scare, and it set that off in me.
Yeah.
And I think when I finally was able to sit down at my desk and sit in my chair long enough to string sentences together, it was the only story that mattered to me. Was what do you do with that kind of uncontrollable? What do you do with simply the fact that you can't control life?
Mm.
The old great existential dilemma. We all know that on any given day, anything can happen. But if you really thought about that, it would be completely paralyzing. So, at one point in the book, Rachel says, "Every single thing we do matters." Every blessed thing, she says. And that was really important to me, because she's really having this moment where she thinks, You turn left to walk down the street one way, you turn right to walk down the street the other way, and your whole life can change.
Yes.
But thinking that way all the time would drive anybody crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a matter of making some sort of peace with the lack of control that we, in fact, have as human beings. And that's really what I wanted to try to write about.
You're listening to Writers on Writing, and my guest is Danny Shapiro, author of the novel Family History. One thing I liked about the book is, sort of as you're talking about your own life, the end of the book is not this, you know, happy, wrapped in ribbons ending.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very kind of realistic, hopeful ending, mm-hmm. but it's, you know, it's, it was nice. I really loved your ending. It,
mm-hmm.
you know, sometimes
I'm so glad.
These books that are, are emotional, novels that are emotional, just sometimes end a little too brightly.
Yeah, yeah. I knew that that this couldn't be wrapped up in a ribbon. And yet, I also really wanted there to be hope at the end, not because I wanted some, you know, great big redemptive ending. In fact, I didn't want some great big redemptive ending, but because I really did see hope for these, for this family.
Mm-hmm.
I saw them as being extremely courageous and really sort of struggling, fighting a very noble fight to remain intact, because not because they should, but because they love each other. And I see them at the end of the book as being kind of, and they've been through a lot. But this is actually the first books that I've written that I could imagine wanting to revisit someday.
Mm-hmm.
I could see myself 10 years from now wanting to check in, you know, and start writing about the Jensens again to see where they are.
Yeah,
because
that's interesting.
They're left at a spot. I mean, a lot of readers have asked me or written to me and asked what happens to Kate, the daughter, and, you know, whether Kate's going to be okay, because Kate's, you know, she's a teenager in quite a bit of trouble, and different readers interpret that differently. And my answer has been that I think Kate's going to be a really interesting 30-year-old someday,
mm-hmm.
you know, who will have been through a lot in her life. But is she going to be okay? Yeah, she's going to be great, but she's going to have had a past.
Hmm. Oh, well, I wanted to ask you a little bit more in terms of then going back to dealing with, say, panic disorder.
Mm-hmm.
You were on medication, and then you chose to go off it,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of an unusual thing to do, I think, once people get on medication for you know, various challenges, they stay on it.
Mm-hmm.
And the thought of leaving it is just impossible. Will you talk about that, about why you did that?
I have a very mixed, you know, just personally very mixed feeling about medication, because... And it's not really rational. It's a few different things. One is that I watched my father be addicted to painkillers for most of his adult life, and so pills scare me, even though there's nothing addictive about, you know, SSRIs. They're just scary to me. Any Tylenol is scary to me. You know,
mm-hmm.
Motrin is scary to me.
Right.
So I didn't like taking a pill every day. I also, it's interesting, when I was taking an SSRI, I actually wondered if it was affecting my work. And in retrospect, I don't think it was affecting my work. I think it was affecting how I felt about my work. I felt less connected to it, because one of the things that that kind of drug does take away from you is obsessiveness.
Mm-hmm.
And to write a novel, you have to be a little obsessive. And so, I mean, by obsessive, I mean kind of ruminative, thinking about it all the time. And I found myself unable to think about anything all the time. So that was some of my...
Mm-hmm.
But I don't remotely rule it out, because I mean, panic is a terrible thing to feel, and I just don't. Nobody should have to just live with it. But there are a lot of I mean, I've done all sorts of things. I've done behavioral therapy. It's largely about, for me anyway, making peace with it,
mm-hmm.
and understanding. I mean, that I can even talk about this on the radio is amazing to me, because five years ago I couldn't have put a label on it.
Yeah.
And 10 years ago, if you had asked me, if you had used the word anxiety, I would have looked at you puzzled, like, what's that? I didn't even know that I was anxious.
Hmm.
I didn't know what it was. And really, when I look back and try to understand it now, it's the story of my life. It's the story of choices that I made. It's a story of how I lived at certain times. It's now looking back and really having done a lot of work on it that I see that and I understand it.
Mm. Well, I like how your character is sort of dealing with this, and I love your nonfiction too, where you write about it. I think that's just, you know, necessary.
Well, get this. You know, it's funny. I recently realized with my nonfiction, if the thought of writing about it makes me nauseous,
mm-hmm.
then I know I have to write about it. And I've written several personal essays now that, as I was writing them, I really, the thought that they would be read really never entered into my mind, even though I wasn't being disingenuous. I knew they were going to be published, but I didn't think about it, because it's kind of a trick I play on myself with my creative nonfiction, because it's the only way that I can do it. And it's not, I mean, I've got a list as long as my arm of bad reasons to write personal essays.
Mm-hmm.
Revenge would be one. Confession would be another. Exhibitionistic, you know, impulse would be another. Every once in a while somebody will say something to me like, how can you stand being so exposed? And what I realized recently is that, yes, it is exposing, but it's my way of saying, understand this, you know, understand me. This is, this is what the inside looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the best personal essays aren't when a writer says that is kind of approaching it that way, of understand this, understand me, it's about something universal.
Right.
It's about something that, I mean, in the case of the piece I wrote about panic disorder, my entire mandate to myself with that piece was, this is a wordless feeling. How can I give it words? If I can find a way to actually capture, for someone who's never experienced this, what it feels like, I will have accomplished something.
Mm-hmm.
And if I have captured for someone who does know what it feels like, but has never been able to put it into words, then I will have accomplished something. And I just wanted to do that.
You did it.
Thank you.
Yeah, I found a lot of, well, I went to your website, which is DaniShapiro.com. That's DaniShapiro.com, where you can read the essay that we're talking about, and also other essays and stories. And it's a beautiful website, actually.
Thanks.
By the way. Just sort of really taking a left turn here or a right turn. Have you started any of your work, whether it be essays or stories or novels, by first lines or something somebody said, or just hearing words?
Yeah.
Yeah?
They don't usually end up staying that way.
Mm-hmm.
But they do lead me in. Sometimes, and actually especially with essays, I find that I need at least what I think is going to be the first sentence before I can begin.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll be usually thinking about an essay that I know I'm going to be writing. And when the first sentence comes to me is when I can begin.
That's interesting.
But it's important to not stay married to it too.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny. My husband's a writer, and he has a very different process than I do. He's a much messier writer. He'll start in the middle and loop his way back around again, and he'll write, you know, pages and pages just to kind of warm up. And I'm a neater writer, for better or worse. It's sort of like I need to make the bed in the morning, and he doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
it's just the way I am. I need to have an idea of a structure. Not an idea of a structure, but one sentence leading to the other, and the way that the words sound and sit on the page before I can proceed. But I would say probably half of the time it ends up not being the first sentence. But I certainly have to convince myself that it is.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Oh, my. 3 minutes left. What can we talk about of the million things? You'll just have to come back when your next book comes out.
I would love to.
I wanted to go back a little bit. Were you able to write when your son was ill? Were you able to concentrate? And if so, how?
I really had a almost impossible time writing when he was ill. And as it turned out, and really as luck would have it, Slow Motion, my memoir, had been bought as a movie. And my husband, who is now a screenwriter, he used to be a journalist, and he's now a screenwriter, and he and I were hired by Sony Phoenix Pictures to write it. And that is probably the only project that I could have actually done while my son was sick, because I was working on it with a partner
mm-hmm.
who was also going through the same thing I was going through. We would just close ourselves off in a room together for a few hours a day and work. And also, screenwriting is so different from writing prose. It's not as dense. I'm not remotely saying it's easier. I can't do it well. In many ways, I think it's not even that it's harder. It's just its own animal. But we were doing that, and it was a godsend, because I could never have been working on a novel during that time.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know how that happens, how people do that, how writers do
I
that.
Longed for a day job mm-hmm. during that time, because, you know, when you're a writer, your head is where you live. And if your head is in a distracted or uncomfortable or painful place, that's all you've got.
Yeah.
I mean, during that time, I would just sit at my desk, and I would stare out the window, and I'd think, I should go to medical school. Medical school, that's where it's at.
Mm-hmm.
Doctors, they really do something.
Oh dear! I know you, and you're probably such a calm person on the outside.
On the surface, oh my God!
I mean,
you bet.
It's like people say to me, "Oh, you can't possibly be anxious. You're so calm and patient. I'm like, mm-hmm. you don't know what's mm-hmm. going on here."
Mm-hmm.
We are at the end of our time. We have another minute or so. I wonder if you would offer any advice to writers listening, mm-hmm. writers perhaps who are dealing with a novel that is either difficult in subject matter or just difficult to write.
I hope this sounds less trite than I think it might, but be true to yourself. Do not pander to whatever you think the marketplace is. If you're writing short stories, write short stories. Don't think, oh, short stories, you know, collections of short. I mean, I hear all this from my students all the time. The ones that write what they think is going to sell, that doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
It's slow and steady really truly does win the race. And I think it can be hard in graduate school, particularly, to remember that. Because it can be even harder to remember that if you're out there kind of laboring on your own. And one other thing that I would say is, it's not this big mystery, publishing. There aren't great novels sitting in drawers gathering dust because a writer couldn't find an agent or couldn't find a publisher. Good work does find its way, and it's not about connections. It's entirely about doing a good piece of work.
Hmm. Yes. Well, I so appreciate you taking the time, especially during your blackout that we connected.
That was my pleasure.
Thanks so
really
much.
Really nice talking to you.
Great to talk to you.
Bye, Barbara.
Bye. That was Danny Shapiro, author of Family History, a novel published by Knopf. Her website again is DaniShapiro.com. It's DaniShapiro.com. Check it out. It's a beautiful site and lots of links to essays, stories, and other stuff. If you have any comments or questions or would like to know about future guests in the area or events in the area, you can go to my website at writersonwriting.com, and there you can sign up to be on the mailing list or just write to me at writersonwriting@earthlink.net. And next week I won't be here. There's going to be poetry here with Steve Sherlock, so I hope you'll tune in and check that out. I'd like to end with a quote by Diane Ackerman, who said, "There is no way in which to understand the world without first detecting it through the radar net of our senses." You've been listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned for Between the Lines with James. Meet you here next week.